Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the Coleman Had a Dream podcast. I am here, as always, with Ruth. How are you doing, Ruth?
Good, good. Spring and summer starting to arrive here. So, yeah, no, it's nice. It's lovely. How about you?
I would love to say the same here, but it is absolutely pouring down with rain today, and it's thoroughly miserable as we record. I think we've had summer in the Netherlands. It was lovely last week while I was on May break. You know, temperature up in the 20s. I got a nice red nose. And a normal service has been resumed. We are here to talk to you today, not about the state of my nose, but in fact to talk to you about Welsh football. Obviously, it's the end of the season, so we were looking at doing a bit of a roundup, but obviously we are far from club experts, so we thought rather than do a full review of the season, so to speak, we're going to kind of try and address some of the bigger picture issues looking ahead for some of these clubs into next season, and that's what we're going to address. We're going to discuss the Welsh football as well, the Cymru Premier and what happened there, as well as the Welsh Blood Cup final. We're going to talk about the Women's Nations League draw. We are going to talk about a lot today, as well as a few other any other businesses at the end. Ruth, it is good to be back talking about football, I think.
Yeah, we've had a little hiatus, haven't we? But it's been a bit of busy month. There's certainly been a lot of talking points.
I was going to say, it's certainly not been quiet for Welsh football teams, is it? Before we start, I just want to do a little bit of housekeeping and do some thanks to you. So I've been talking about doing this for a week or so, but I wanted to make sure we did it on the pod. I wanted to say a big thank you to everyone who supported us on buymeacoffee.com/Coleman's Dream. Alid, Gwillem and Lazy Boy Hits Car, which is Nick Latham, have all supported us recently. I'm exceptionally grateful for everyone who's making a little donation to support us. Obviously, this is a hobby of ours, but it's far from free. So every donation we have to kind of keep things going is very much gratefully received. So if you do want to go to buymeacoffee.com/Coleman's Dream and make drop a few quid in that can help us and support us, we'd be very, very grateful. Equally, if you would like to go to bagsybags.com and use the code CHAD10, you will get 10% off anything on their website. So please do that, support him, and in doing so, support us as we get a little cut of that sale as well. So thank you to everyone who has done that. I know several people have, so thank you very much for contributing. Ruth, let's talk about your favourite football team. Ruth is obviously a North Walian, so is more than happy to be talking about Wrexham. Were you able to watch any games for them towards the end of the season?
Yes and no. I got to watch a few. The key one I got to watch the Notts County game, so that was the key one to watch. What a few minutes that was at the end. It's just difficult to sort of underestimate the impact of all this. I think, first off, incredibly happy for the town. Well, it's a city now, isn't it? Incredibly happy for the city. There is something very visceral about how Wrexham supporters love their team, and I think we can all appreciate the sort of the love and the dedication. They wouldn't exist if the supporters hadn't stepped in 10, 12 years ago and, you know, literally put their money where their mouth is and kept the club alive. And I think to see their faith and their determination rewarded after so many years, it's just great. And it's such a fillip for North Wales as a whole. I think it's, we're clearly one nation. There isn't any doubt about that. But there's the sort of North Walian psyche is different from other parts of the country. And I think the role that Wrexham plays in North Wales is really important. It's such a sort of key industrial hub over the years for North Wales. And I think to see it decline as a hub and to see its sort of place in North Wales decline, that's just very much reflected in what's been happening with the football club. And I think all of this is just such a fillip to the area in terms of boosting people's self-confidence and faith and ability just to take risks and try things and do things and be sort of assertive and affirmative. I think all of that is rolled up in this experience of what the town has been going through. And I think my joy is in seeing the impact on the wider community.
I think it's hard, as you said at the start, to understate that. I think a friend of mine, Tom, who I'm confident will not be listening, he said he is the grumpiest man alive as well, to be fair. But he said that, you know, he woke up and he was watching all this stuff and everyone was glowing. He was just like, what is all this fuss about? Wrexham have done this because two millionaires have come and pumped a load of money into this. Like, you know, come on, be realistic. And I said to him, like, he needs to go back and look at what has happened to Wrexham Football Club and what has been through. Because as you say, Ruth, the club wouldn't exist without the fans. And I you know, it's far from a unique situation, but they are, you know, they did put their money where their mouth was all those years ago. And they finally got a good reward for that. And, you know, and it doesn't happen to many football teams. And it's great that it has happened to them and they have got the reward that they deserve, frankly, from all of this. I think you talked about what it's done for Wrexham and for North Wales in general, but I also think that Rob and Ryan have done so much for just Wales in general. I think, especially in America, I was listening to the Edge Foff pod on my way home today, and they were talking about, you know, now they've entered League Two, they're going to be talking about financial fair play, and, you know, they can't just go and spend the money they want to spend. But, you know, the amount of revenue that they're generating for the club through their own exposure of how great North Wales is, and how great Wales in general is, and just where Wales is, the language and everything else that goes along with it. You know, people didn't know that. You know, I've lived in America, you still live there. You know, it really wasn't that long ago that when I got into a cab in Boston and said, you know, someone said, where are you from? And I said, I'm from Wales. That the cab driver said, where in London's that? You know, like, I mean, that is a genuinely true anecdote. And, you know, that happened. And I think that what these guys have done have made such a real impact on Wales as a whole, as well as just Wrexham as a city, as a football club, and everything else that's gone with that. So I think huge credit needs to be given to them for that. How do you
I think it's very difficult to underestimate the impact of the documentary over here.
Yeah, I agree.
It's like nothing that's on television over here. The sort of the rawness of it, the, you know, dirt under the fingernails kind of town that it is. You know, I think there's so much glitz and glamour on the telly over here that to see something this kind of real is actually really impactful. And I also think there was a very clever use of two key skill sets. There was the bringing in people who knew what they were doing in terms of the football, people like Sean Harvey and obviously Phil Parkinson, Fleur Robinson, Les Reed, you know, the key kind of football decision-making people. They went way above their kind of weight category in terms of who they were pulling in those key roles. That obviously has made a key difference. And then obviously just leveraging everything that the pair of them and their teams know about the entertainment industry over here in particular, the power of social media, you know, pulling in people like Expedia and TikTok and getting that kind of media footprint going before the documentary even was, you know, was aired. There was a hubbub around the team on social media here prior to the documentary starting. So when the documentary started, there was an anticipation already about what that could deliver. And I think the momentum built, and then obviously the documentary is going to impact income hugely, potentially. Then there's, interestingly, as they go into League Two, there's actually more restrictions on them. So it will be interesting to see how they navigate that. But obviously, the key thing is how they've used the pool of expertise on the football side and the pool of expertise on the entertainment industry side. And I think it's a very interesting model that of what they've been able to leverage between the two of them and the sort of the canniness and the nounce of both of those camps. The mission statement is actually quite interesting because to a large extent they've sort of achieved a lot of things on the mission statement that, you know, grow the team, yeah, clearly, return to the EFL, well, there's a big gold star against that, increased attendance at the racecourse, obviously that's yeah, up and is maximised at the minute, improved the stadium, clearly there's things being done already, but the main development there is at the COP, just buying the stadium is a huge plus there. And then the most important thing is the positive difference to the wider community in and around Wrexham. And I think, you know, you've only got to look at the what's happening in the city, the number of visitors the city's getting, the growth of the urban sort of confidence there. That's wonderful. And I think that'll be the interesting thing to see as they go into two, because they're now not the big fish in quite the same way. I mean, they're the big fish financially, I think it's fair to say, but they're not quite the big fish in terms of the status of the league as they go into League Two. So I think there's a lot of things still to watch and still to learn and still to experience here. And I'm just so glad to even very tangentially be on the journey. It's just a wonderful way to watch my home area, you know, kind of shout about what it has to offer to the world.
I think a lot of this as well, we talk about these things a lot when we're talking about Wales and qualifying for things and whatever, but a lot of it I think is about hope as a football fan. Like, I don't think there's any or many football fans, unless you're Real Madrid fans or Man City fans, where you probably expect to win something every year. You know, and I think for a lot of football fans, the thing is the hope, right? You want your team to be competing. You want things to be trying to move forward. Even if you don't get there, you want to be trying to go in the right direction. And, you know, that's why, for example, if we take the politics aside for a sec, I'm enjoying Newcastle so much at the minute. If we come in the Champions League spots, great. If we don't, okay. But we're finally, after years of neglect, going in the right direction. And I think that, you know, Wrexham fans would probably feel the same after what has probably felt like a long time. It's just a fight to survive. You know, they've now gone way and above that, and not only are they looking up, it's also about hope for the future. And I think that's all you ever can kind of ask for as a football fan, in my opinion anyway, is that you want your team to be in the conversation for winning things, and you want to believe that there's a chance that you can do well. And I think Wrexham have given their fans that, they've given the town that, they've given the city that, you know, a real boost to the area in total. And it's not just about what they've provided in a footballing sense in regards to hope, but also I think the region, the area, that, you know, everything involved in it, I think is been fascinating. And I think I agree with you. I think I found the documentary and similar in parts anyway to the Sunderland documentary, obviously without the absolute hilarity of them getting relegated at the end twice. But, you know, without the slapstick ending, I think the thing that endears people to that documentary about the Mackhams is that it is real people. It's real fun. Even I enjoyed it for that reason. You're having real conversations and a real insight into people's lives. And I think it opens the door for people, especially like people who don't like football as much. Like my wife Joy is obviously, despite the amount of time I spend watching football, thinking about football, talking about football, you know, she doesn't really like it. But I think it's the stories, and she was fascinated by the documentary and the unique perspectives that it gives and makes people understand why you care so much about it. And I think that's such a rare thing to be able to tap into. But yeah, I suppose we do not want to wax lyrical too much about just Wrexham, because obviously we want to talk about lots of other teams. But before we move on, Ruth, just a quick thought, how you think they will get on next season?
Well, I mean, they're obviously in a place to certainly challenge within League Two. I mean, one of the points I was going to make when we get talking about Newport was the fact that League Two's just got a lot harder with the likes of Wrexham and either Chesterfield or Notts County. Did you see that Notts County playoff game? Did you see their Boreham Wood game?
Well, do you know, I wasn't able to watch the game, but I was keeping an eye on it on my phone, and I saw a tweet about it, and I was like, what is going on there? So I checked the score, and they were 2-0 down. I was like, I'm loath to feel sorry for another football team, but I do feel a bit bad for them. 2-0 down in the semi-final at home. And I was like, bloody hell. And I was in the pub watching, because it was on Sunday, I think, wasn't it? And I went to the pub to watch the Feyenoord game because they're close to winning the league, and then Newcastle were on afterwards. And I was like, bloody hell, I can't believe that. And I looked back at my phone, it was 2-1. I was just like, oh, you never know. And then, of course, at 97th minute, they've got back to 2-2. And then there's a brilliant video that's doing the round. I don't know if you said, I think it might have been BBC that shared it, where it was like the local kind of fan commentary, if you like, for Notts County Channel themselves, and they had a camera on the two commentators for them, and they're kind of talking through the game at 2-2 in the last knock-ins of extra time, when your man, I forget his name, who scores the goal. And these two, it's a brilliant video because these two commentators go mad and they're proper celebrating. And then whilst they're trying to still kind of keep an element of commentary going, there's fans like jumping on top of them and they're trying to celebrate with their fans and whoever. It is a fantastic video. So yeah, I've got to say, I am glad they've got to the final. I think it's well deserved. And one last thing actually, whilst we're talking about them, is I think it is a sign of how genuine I think that the two Americans are, that this is a...
One of them's Canadian. Oh,
sorry, apparently. Well, 601. No, the reason I think they're so genuine is because I think there are people out there now, myself included, who couldn't care less about Notts County, but because they've said all these good things and all these nice things, I do think, well, it is true. You know, they've done well. I would quite like them to go up. So I think it's interesting the impact they've had on everything and lots of different people in all of this, to be perfectly honest. It's been great.
But it was a great example of why you want to finish top of the league. I was just I was nervous enough watching that sort of on their behalf, and I'm like, thank God.
Last thing, actually, I've said last thing three times now, but I also think it's worth referencing some of the pictures and everything else that have come out of them in Vegas and whatever. I mean, I'm genuinely quite surprised you haven't popped down to Nevada, Ruth, just to go and say hello to the boys. But the one thing that stuck me was they had a picture of them in some bar or like some pool party the other day, and Rob McElhenney's there, and he is... I mean, absolutely jacked. Like, he is more ripped than some of the players. Like, it's absolutely unbelievable. I don't know if you saw the picture, but the shape on it was unreal.
No, but maybe I'll look for it.
I was going to say, I'm fully confident that you will be looking that up when we finish recording. Okay, then, let's move to the championship in that case. It's been quite a weird season for Cardiff and Swansea. We'll start with... Swansea, if that's okay, because I feel like they had a slightly more positive end, or at least looking up the league toward the end of the season. They finished only 3 points off the playoffs in the end. Unfortunately, the Dirty Mackems, the Great Unwashed, did sneak in the end by virtue of goal difference, which is horrible. But it was an interesting run to the end of the season, and I feel like this positive momentum is something that Russell Martin can at least, if he does decide to stay, but can at least take into conversations with the owners and the leadership group at the team and at the club, in terms of, you know, trying to keep this squad together.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall, I think 10th in that league, probably about the right sort of place for them when you look at the squad, might be even a bit higher when you consider the other teams are in. I mean, they finished above Watford, they finished above Norwich. They were on the same number of wins as the teams that were in fifth and sixth, ultimately. I'm just not very confident that there is that agenda from the ownership group. I think they're still a selling club. I mean, Pirro is obviously such an asset, but his contract's up in 12 months' time. This would be the summer to cash in on him as an asset. I feel for Martin, because I think it's like, it's almost like a reboot each summer, and he's got such this focused kind of intention in terms of how he wants the team to play. But it takes time for the players to get there, and I think it's really hard if you haven't got that stability. And I think I'm low in confidence that stability is going to exist.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think, you know, hanging on to Pirro is obviously going to be massive for them. I mean, looking at the table, you know, Luton, who finished third, didn't score as many goals as them. Coventry, who finished fifth, didn't score as many goals as them. Blackburn, Millwall, West Brom, Watford, Preston, Norwich, Bristol, Hull, Stoke, continuing to go down the lead. Oh, no one's scored as many as them. I think there's only four teams or five teams who scored as many as them. So a lot of that is down to Pirro. Obviously scored on the last day of the season as well. I think what's the biggest thing that they need to address here, as long as they can hang on to players, is their defence, because they had I think only four teams conceded more goals than Swansea City this season. They conceded 64 goals. And that is mad when you think about it. You know, even looking down the league, the three teams who are going down, Reading conceded 68, Blackpool 72, Wigan 65. When you consider that they're in and around the same sort of ballpark there, Cardiff conceded less than them, Rotherham, Huddersfield, Birmingham. You know, these teams were in the relegation battle right until the end. So that has got to be the biggest area for them to strengthen and develop, I think, a better strategy of how they defend. It's not just the players, right? That's more than just a player issue. They've got to look at how the tactics and formation and everything else fundamentally leads them to defend.
Yeah, I think they're a really interesting team in that sense. It's very small margins in terms of their performance. I'm going to give you a couple of stats here, and you know, I know you like your odd stat. So the XG, which I always take with a pinch of salt, but I do think this is illustrative as it happens. Their XG for goals scored was 1.4, and as it happens, they hit that exactly. They hit 1.4 on their goals scored. Their XG conceded was 1.3, but in reality, they conceded 1.4, and that's a tiny difference. But it's enough, isn't it? As you know, as we said, they were only 3 points off making the playoffs in the end. And so I don't think it's a huge... I mean, you look at the number of games that draws turned into defeats or wins turned into draws in literally the last few minutes of the games. And that became almost a sort of psychological hurdle at one point in the season for them, didn't they? They were almost expecting that to happen. And so I don't think there's a huge twist needed here in terms of how they defend. It just needs to be more solid. And my concern, of course, is that there's going to be some turnover and they'll just start from scratch again.
Yeah, I don't quite think they'll be starting at scratch again, but I take your point. I think the only thing is, you're right, but if you want to be a team that's going to try and get promoted, try and be promoted, make the playoffs, whatever, your XG of conceding goals can't be 1.4 a game. You can't, you know, we're loosely talking about you conceding three goals every two games, give or take. Obviously, maths is not my strong point, but I mean, that's not going to get promoted or even be in that conversation. So I think that is something that definitely needs to address. Personally, I appreciate I've not seen the Swans a huge amount this season, but from the games I have watched, I do maintain that a lot of that comes from their style. And I think they, at the back, at least have to be a little bit more pragmatic. I think they do often hang on to balls in areas of the pitch where they shouldn't. I mean, you reference their late goals in games. That's happened to them a lot, that they've conceded those late goals in games. And I think that's something that, again, it comes from keeping the ball in the wrong areas, using the ball in the wrong place. But, I mean, ultimately, as you say, the thing is going to be keeping Martin, and it's going to be making sure that going ahead that they can recruit and build rather than rebuild, because that is a big difference.
Yeah, I just don't think there's a desire, particularly from the ownership group. I don't think they're looking to move forward. I think they're kind of in neutral almost.
Yeah, I think I think ultimately they just want to keep ticking over and generate a profit for their shareholders at the end of whatever their little project is. And, you know, that is their stated aim, I suppose. I don't think they've been subtle about it. Even I think that's just what they need to do. What they know they want to do. Yeah. So, okay, let's move down the M4 a little bit and look at Cardiff City. Now, I know we are slightly going to be repeating ourselves here, but there's a couple of things that I kind of noticed. I think, you know, they've conceded 58 goals, which is obviously far too many. They have, though, won 13 games. And I say that because Watford in 11th, who ended up being just 6 points off the playoffs, won 16, three more games than them. And I know that we know this, and I know, you know, that doesn't necessarily get you promoted, but that step up the table is actually not, you know, it's not that huge a gap. And I think that in Lamucci, Cardiff have a decent manager who is capable of bridging that gap. He certainly seems to have galvanised the players and the team and you know, balanced out what's been quite a topsy-turvy season toward the end of it. Do you think he's going to be the man, having kept them up, who will stay? Do you think he's the right person, and do you think he's a good person for the job?
Yes, in that, would I like to see him stay? I think, would he be an asset if he did? Yes. My concern for Cardiff would be Tan and Lamucci are meeting this week, apparently. I can't see Tan really investing. I don't think Lamucci will stay unless he can see that there's some sort of financial plan and money available. They've also got this transfer embargo still sort of hanging over them. They can only take loans at the minute. That's obviously under appeal, and there's that seems to be a bit of a moving target at the moment. But as things stand, they've still got embargo problems. So a little bit like the situation with the Swans, I can't see it being attractive for Lamucci to stay under the sort of the present framework that TAN has been operating in terms of lack of investment.
Yeah.
And I worry that they're getting in a vicious circle. I mean, obviously survival in the end was the aim this season, particularly given the managerial circus and the changes that was going on there. And I think he's brought a stability that's got them through the remainder of this season. And I think if they were in a position to actually build on that, I think they could and can move forward. But I worry that then that they're in this sort of quagmire and can't get a good footing going.
I think that's the thing. We talk about this all the time, I feel like, when we talk about Cardiff City. We're always talking about this kind of cycle that they seem to be in of getting themselves out of one hole and in turn kind of digging themselves another to an extent. I feel like Lamucci might be, maybe not in a playing sense, but maybe actually a very good appointment in terms of he might be someone who can take them forward. I feel like, you know, Mick McCarthy, let's say, when he came in, I think we had this conversation, you know, 9 months or so ago. He came in, he was a stopgap. His job was to keep them up. Same way, you know, Sam Allardyce has gone to Leeds. His job is to keep them up. This doesn't progress you. This just fills a hole. And I feel like Lamucci is the one who is someone who doesn't fill that hole. He fills on it and he's trying to build on it. And I think this might finally be an opportunity. If they can convince him to stay, that Cardiff can start to kind of build something steady. And I think, you know, there needs to be changes on the playing side. I think they've got quite an unbalanced squad, light in certain areas and not so much in others. And I think they need to trim that down and make it, you know, more viable for them to progress moving forward. But I also think he seems like someone who would be a good person to get the best out of some of the players he has got and, you know, maximise opportunities for people from a Welsh perspective, like Colwill, like Mark Harris. So I think he'll be someone who, if they can get him to stay, will be a huge asset for Cardiff City and will finally kind of stop this cycle of mediocrity, I'm going to call it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I think he has that potential. I think there needs to be this sort of elusive plan that we've talked about before, the fact that Cardiff don't seem to have a plan. And I think unless that's something on paper in front of him, I'm not sure he's going to stay.
Yeah, I mean, I think he might stay, to be honest. But I agree with you in principle that, you know, he is that man. It depends on the ownership. I think that goes mm-hmm. without saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's finally that time, or hopefully this is the chance that they need, because I think Cardiff have had a real scare this year. And I think that this might be enough to get them to kind of realise, okay, things finally need to change here. So we will see what happens with that. We next go on and talk about Newport County. A strange season for Newport in many ways, really. Mm-hmm. Started off very poorly. I think they had 2 wins in their first 14 games or something like that. They've ended up about 20 points, 21 points in the end, 19 points off the playoffs. And that's obviously a very sizable gap. I think my big concern for Newport is that they are beginning a bit of a cycle like Cardiff have been, in the sense that they had Flynn, they wanted to play a certain style of football, they wanted to improve. You know, they've definitely punched above their weight in terms of being in and around the playoffs with a much lower budget. Couldn't quite get across the line. Robbery was brought in, you know, keep that style of play going, but, you know, now we kind of want to have the results with it. Realised the results weren't going to come, so they've just thought, God, right, okay, who's going to, you know, keep us away from any trouble and who's just going to do what needs to be done? Who's going to make us hard working? And I think once you change that style, having tried to do it for a little bit, it becomes very, very difficult to kind of snap out of that again. And I do have a slight concern for Newport. I don't think they'll go down or anything like that, but I do worry that they might get, again, I'll use it again, this little cycle of mediocrity, really, where they're just battling to almost stay afloat.
Yeah, I mean, I think Graham Coughlan has brought some sort of pragmatism to their play, which by the point in the season was needed. I think one of the problems that League Two teams have, most League Two teams have, is there's such, contracts are relatively short. There's so much turnover year on year with the playing staff that building is actually really difficult unless you can genuinely invest and get some, you know, some 2 and 3, 4 year contracts in place as opposed to just these sort of 12 month rolling contracts, which are much more common. As we were saying before, I think League Two just got harder. I think the teams that are coming up are better markedly better teams than the teams that are going down. So overall, the, you know, the quality of football is going to go, is going to go up. It's going to be harder to get out of that league.
Very true.
I think there were some interesting things that Coughlin said. There was a BBC interview that he gave where he was talking about, you know, sort of a review of the season. But the parts that really struck me was where he was talking about County off the field. And there was things like he was saying it's not healthy, and like the behaviour of football operations that was there wasn't healthy, wasn't professional, belonged in the non-leagues. You know, there wasn't expertise, there wasn't experience there. I think that's actually really, one, it's interesting, but it's actually quite concerning because I think from the outside looking in, there's been an assumption that, that County was actually a very reasonably well kind of organized and structured and embedded in the community, kind of, you know, like a good League Two team in that sense. And I think these observations are really interesting from him. And I wonder what that means going forward in terms of where the priority needs to be, because you can't build on the field if this stuff behind isn't solid.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's always going to be the problem with the financial situation, I guess, at Newport. I'm not really sure that's going to be able to change, which is unfortunate, but says a lot. Hopefully, something does change, and there is some kind of development, I think, is what I'm looking for off the pitch. Mm-hmm. So, let's hope there is progress there. I think the big thing for them is hanging on to certain players. Omar Bogle obviously is the big one, really, with 17 goals this season. He's again, I've only seen Newport a couple of times, but he looks like he must be an absolute pain in the arse to play against. He's got good ball control. He's got good awareness of around him. He's dynamic. He's very strong, very physical player. So I think hanging on to him is going to be a big must for Newport.
Yeah, his contract's up next summer as well. I wonder if it might be one of those cases of you see what the situation is in January, whether you're actually challenging for promotion or not, whether you're safe from relegation or not, and whether you cash in on the asset then. I don't know. I think it's really hard for teams in Newport's position to keep hold of players, particularly strikers that are scoring goals in that league. I think there's so many teams that are sniffing around, and you don't have to offer someone much more than a percentage increase can make a huge difference when you're looking at the contracts that players have in that league. And I think it's really hard to keep someone that's put in goals at the rate that he is.
Yeah, I agree. I think also keeping Cameron Norman is someone else who was one of their player of the year. He's on a 2-year deal, so his deal is coming up at the end of June, ultimately, or the start of June, sorry. So, you know, that's someone else that they need to make sure they kind of tie in and start to build things around, because there's two very promising young players there, and I think, you know, they need to build on that ultimately. So that's going to be key for them, I think. I think also for them to try and move up the table a little bit is going to be something that will show signs of progression, especially for the manager coming in. He'll want to be doing something that's going to make a positive difference. I do worry a little bit for Newport, but hopefully, as is often the case on this podcast, I will be wrong. We shall see. To continue what we wanted to talk about today, Ruth, the Women's Nation League draw was made about a week or so ago, 10 days ago now. Wales drew Germany, Denmark and Iceland, which is an incredibly tough group. I think the Germans may be second or third in the world. I think the Danes and the Icelandics are something about 14, 15 in the world, and I think we're 23 or so, something like that, 28 maybe. So, yeah, 31. Sorry, it's just come back to me. We're 31 in the world. So, yeah, obviously a big jump for us. I think, obviously, tough draw, but I think if we want to be competing with these teams in tournaments, in competitions, in playoffs, we've got to test ourselves against these teams, and I think this is a great opportunity for us to do that.
Agree with that. I mean, given we were in pot four for this A-tier league, you know, there was always going to be serious other teams coming out of pots one and two in particular. So, you know, I don't think we would have had a draw terribly different from this, regardless of how it had come out. I think you're always going to have a challenging group. I do actually think it's a really, really good building block for us. Obviously, Granger and the team at the FAW have been working hard to organise friendlies against higher opposition. But I think when we played Switzerland in the playoffs, I think the gap was still evident. I think the gap has closed, and I think it's small, but I think it was still evident. And I think this Nations League, these games give us an opportunity to play good opposition in a more testing environment. And I think this is... We're actually exactly the sort of team, I think, that the Nations League can help. And you've seen it. We've seen it in the men's games, and hopefully we can capitalise it here with the women's team.
I totally agree. The example you've given of Switzerland there is something I was going to say as a milestone, if you like, for progression. Obviously, a couple of years ago, we got pipped to the post in the playoffs by Northern Ireland, who went on and progressed. We beat them in a friendly, I think, was it 4-0 recently, 5-0? You know, that is a real sign and a show of progression. In the same way, we've then come up against that Switzerland side in the playoffs and we've not done what we needed to do, admittedly, in the most heartbreaking of fashion. We've got so close, and it's just showing you that gap is there, but we are trying to bridge it. We are starting to trend in that direction almost, and I think that it's massively important that in these games, that's the one thing I would like to see, is that, yes, we've got to keep improving, be it style of play and what we're trying to do and all that stuff, but I think it's massively important that we also start to develop some other players. One big thing about Granger is that she doesn't really seem fussed on using her squad, especially in some of these friendly games. She's not really given many other people game time, which I've not really understood. Mm-hmm. Even if it's at the expense of a result, we've got to start doing it here. We've got to have the next generation of people coming through, given more opportunities. People like Josie Green is a perfect example, I think, someone who's a talented young player. She needs game time so that if she's called on in a game, in a big occasion game, be it a qualifier or a playoff or whatever, she's ready. I mean, she's not really played proper minutes for Wales for a couple of years now, and I appreciate she was injured before that, but, you know, she's a great example of someone who's good, who's playing at a high level. She needs to be given game time, and I think there's a few others in that position, and I really hope that this Nations League group is an opportunity for us to do that.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it is. I think it's a growth point, isn't it? And I think we've just got to maximise that.
As we are talking about the women's team here, Ruth, do you want to talk about the Q&A thing with Noel Mooney at this point?
Yeah, I mean, last, when was it, Friday, there was an event at in Newport where the FAW had a sort of special evening. There was some films shown and guests, but one of the key parts was a Q&A with Noel Mooney that... Ellis James acted as a sort of compere, and then Mooney just worked through his questions. And obviously, I'm really, really pleased to see this sort of thing being done. There was a lot of ground covered with the questions that were explored. I have to keep reminding myself, as someone who suffered through the FAW of the 1980s and 90s, that we are clearly, clearly in a very different place. The awarding to the FAW of that... best sports organisation in the UK is very testament to that. Mooney answered questions about sort of player development, the balance between the international games on the men's and women's side, the domestic scene. But it was pretty low on specifics. And, you know, maybe I'm naive. Maybe it isn't that avenue for specifics, really. I suppose, you know, you should be looking at FAW reports and development plans and that sort of thing. But there was a lot of kind of, oh, the FAW is full of great people, lovely people, you know, sort of trust us, we're doing the right thing. And in fairness, every interaction I've had with the FAW and the FAW that we see sort of out in public, that's true. You know, we've both had various interactions with them around the pod, and it's been nothing, they've been nothing but great and helpful and all that sort of, you know, that side thing is very positive. But I was a little bit disappointed with Mooney kind of really exploring the nitty-gritty of what's going on. There was an, you know, looking at the World Cup and the disappointment and the analysis of that. And I understand he's not going to sit there in a bar in Newport and say, well, we got this wrong, we got that wrong, we got the other wrong. But, I mean, like Ian Mitchell's return on the psychology side, that was sort of acknowledged as a whole that had been there when we were in Qatar. And that's like, that's not rocket science. You know, you look at the impact that Ian Mitchell had when we were in the Euros. You look at how important he was as part of the England setup. You look at the leaning that is put on the psychology of the game now. It does not seem unreasonable that that should have been a red flag ahead of the World Cup. And I'm just using, that was probably about the most specific he got in terms of gaps around the World Cup organisation and preparation. But I think, yeah, I just got to keep reminding myself that we're in such a better place that to even be concerned about what Mooney is saying on a stage on a Friday night in a bar in Newport is like, still a good place to be.
Yeah, I agree. I do think there's a positive to that, to play devil's advocate a bit, which is obviously they've recognised something, they've learned from it, and they've rectified that. Obviously, it should have been in place beforehand. I know what you mean. I do have similar reservations in certain degrees in certain things we say and that are publicly said. I think we say a lot of outwardly, or he says at least a lot of outwardly publicly positive things. I don't always know where they're going or what they mean, but I think it's also really important that we're actually critical of these things, because you're right, it is just a bar on a Friday night in Newport, but ultimately this is also, you know, these things matter to the fans and to the people involved, and they mean something, and there's positive progress needed, and if we are going to keep improving, we can't sit on our laurels and go, well, we've got to 2 Euros in a World Cup, well done us. We've got to question each other. We've got to keep pushing things. And if we think there's a fan group that something isn't good enough, then I think it's reasonable to request answers and reasons why, because we do need that. I think we need that to keep improving. And I think that's really, really important. So hopefully things will.
I think it's the domestic scene that's the most concerning. I mean, we're going to talk about what happened with the Colwyn Bay, for example. And I think there's still a lot of things that need addressing about getting the domestic scene in a really healthy place.
I agree. And I think that's my one thing as we come into the domestic type of football now is, you know, there's, you know, TNS are absolutely dominating. They're the only team that can afford to be a full-time team. Mm-hmm. You know, there needs to be, and I don't know what the solution is, but there needs to be something done to level things up a little bit in terms of even in the playing field to make it a better product. And ultimately, that's what this needs to come down to in a very cynical sense, is that it does need to be a better product. I've suggested before, and we've talked about it on this podcast, I've suggested summer football before, which I do still think has positive elements to it. And I appreciate it doesn't have a positive element for some fans, given the distances they've got to travel. But Friday night football is something that I've experienced here in the Netherlands, where I've talked about it on this pod before. It is brilliant knowing on a Friday night that you're going to go and watch your football team play, and you go straight to the pub and you go to, you know, there's no other competition. There's no other games happening. There's always football on a Friday night. Friday, Mondays are when the Dutch second tier plays. There's no real clashes with it. All the Eredivisie stuff happens on a Saturday, Sunday. Is it great that you have to sometimes watch a team like Ado, my team, played last night? Is it great that I have to watch that on a Monday night? Well, you know, obviously I'd rather be, you know, at the pub, and makes it harder to go to games. And I do understand that argument. But I do wonder if it might be interesting to have a prime time Friday evening viewing slot for Welsh football as some sort of priority. But anyway, that is a conversation for another day. Let's look at what happened in this season. Flint go down on the last day of the season. Aber survive last minute goals aplenty, causing that causing that drama. Colwyn Bay and Barry coming up. Obviously, lots of drama on that last day, but also great that two big names in Welsh football terms are coming back into the top flight.
Yeah, I mean, Flint might argue with that. I think the balance that comes from Colwyn Bay and Barry being involved is important. I think, you know, I think it's interesting that Colwyn Bay have come back from the English pyramid and now, you know, obviously firmly embedded in the Cymru League structure again. I do think it's hopefully they're both positive impacts on the league, but I think it goes back to what you were saying about the level of the product. When you've got one team in TNS, it's a little bit like the argument that was being made against Wrexham in the National League, that you're operating in a different environment. And I think we've just got to be careful that we don't let that snowball and the gap just grow. And it's difficult to see how the gap can't grow when the financial situation is so different for these clubs.
Absolutely. And I think part of growing it is getting extra fans in, mm-hmm. and especially younger fans. I think a lot of fans in Wales, you know, using myself as an example, I'm a Newcastle fan. You know, I have a soft spot for Barry Town because they're up the road. I would never have been a Barry Town fan because I didn't know about it. I didn't know, you know, and that was at a time when they were good. It's about hooking people into these teams and these clubs in certain areas. It's a bit different for Barry because obviously they've got, Cardiff City just around the corner. Newport aren't a million miles away either. So there's easy kind of different links there. But in certain parts of Wales, there aren't many other alternative clubs to hook people in unless people do what I did and became a Newcastle fan or, you know, a Liverpool fan or whatever. So I think it's important that we get some people, especially young people, into that. I've got to say that when I went to Merthyr at the start of the season, watched pre-season friendly there, they did that brilliantly, I thought. They let the younger ultras, for want of a better expression, they were kind of in their own section behind one goal. And it helped generate an atmosphere, but that's what you want. You want these young people in from an early age supporting this team and being part of that club. And I really think that's super important. And to help that, in the Premier, JD, Cymru Premier European playoff final, which is going to be held on Saturday between Newtown and Haverford West County, there will be free tickets to that match, which I think is a great move and something that's really, really important to try and get other people in, try and get locals into these teams. Obviously Newtown hosting this one, but neutrals who would be, you know, coming in and watching this product, watching some good football, hopefully, and hopefully getting drawn into supporting these teams.
Hadn't heard about that. That's a really good positive move.
So that is the playoff final, Newtown, Haverford West County. Very much putting you on the spot here, Ruth, which I absolutely love to do. We've had a question in regarding who we think might win that game. Gaz Williams has sent us a message. Who do you want or think will win the European playoff game? Would you want to hazard any guesses there, Ruth?
I would go with Newtown just because of the home advantage. I think they're most likely to take it. I can't say that I've really got a skin in the game in either of those, I'll be honest.
Yeah, it's been, you know, it was tight for them in the first phase of the season. Newtown was sixth, Haverford West was seventh. Admittedly 5 points between them, but they are quite two very closely matched teams. Obviously, they won their playoff games to get them to this point. But yeah, for me, I would say Newtown as well. I think they look like the most likely, especially being at home. And had a better run in the league as well. So that is who I would go for.
I can see from a kind of footballing development point of view, down in Southwest Wales, it would be great if Haverford could pull this out, because I think we want this to be a strong league, genuinely nationally, and I think it's important that means that it is, you know, representative of the country as a whole.
Yeah. No, I agree. Looking at slightly less positive things, the Welsh Blood Service League Cup final was on the 29th of April. Colwyn Bay, in the end, fielded a development side. Obviously, disappointing in the sense that that was the outcome that was kind of handed to them. In a sense, the game was moved 6 weeks ahead of the final, which was disappointing. There was always a provisional date for that final in hand, but obviously changing the date of the cup final 6 weeks ahead of time is far from ideal. What was your take on the situation?
Well, interestingly, in Colwyn Bay's statement, they said that they finally found out the date on April the 14th, whereas the league said they made the decision on March 13th. Now, those two timelines are very different.
Yeah.
When you consider that the league was due to finish on the 15th of April and then ended up finishing on the 29th. So I think there's some questions around the timeline of the decision. I just don't think you can have a semi-professional league move the end date of the season and expect there not to be consequences. In fairness to Colwyn Bay, I think my sympathies are with Colwyn Bay here. It doesn't seem unreasonable that the players would have plans that they're booking trips at a point in the year where they can notionally get away. Pre-season starts really early relatively these days. Something like this, I doubt holiday trip insurance would cover, the fact that your football team have got a game. You book time off work, your partner's book time off work. I don't think it's unreasonable that the players ended up in this position given the dates. I think there should be a mechanism where maybe from the start, there's an understanding that perhaps 2, maybe 3 weeks after the end of the season, it would be better if everybody didn't make plans, because knowing Welsh weather, we've almost inevitably going to get a scenario where there's some changes in the schedule in the late spring caused by delays and games that are cancelled in the winter. So I think maybe they have to build in a buffer, like consciously build in a buffer. But I think when you're dealing with semi-professional leagues, I don't think you can change dates and somehow expect it all just to slot into place smoothly.
I think that's the thing for me, is that, you're talking about it being semi-professional there. This slaps of being amateur hour, doesn't it? Moving.
Yes, yeah.
Regardless of whether the timeline is a couple of weeks or 6 weeks, to change the date of a cup final, for whatever reason, 6 weeks ahead of time, just isn't a great look. And we're talking about wanting to build the game in Wales, and we're talking about wanting to build the profile of it and get more people involved. No, so few people will want to be involved if this sort of amateurish way of running things is the case. It will frustrate people, it'll piss people off. If my team got to a cup final, I was excited to go to a cup final, and it turned out they were going to play the under-18s because they were all the... I'd be absolutely furious. And, even as you say there, there needs to be a system in place to, if things get moved... If the system in place is things get moved, it shouldn't be the cup final. Everything should work around that. And I get that you want the cup final to be the last game of the season, but it can't be to the detriment of everything else that's going on around it. And I don't know. It struck me as a very disappointing way to end the season. And I don't know. It is semi-pro, but unprofessional, because it can't be this way. And I don't want to dig at the FAW too much here. In a national, well, certainly not in a national sense, but in a club sense, I feel like there seems to be, mad stuff happening all the time. And, we're at this time of year again now where people are applying for licenses for promotion and relegation. And I can't abide it. And it makes a mockery of the rest of the league season, because a lot of it then comes down to finance and what people can and can't do and can't afford. And I think it was Llantwit Major, I think, maybe who were in this situation last season. And, again, I don't have the answers. I don't know what the solutions are. And a lot of it, unfortunately, is finance-based. More's got to be done to support these teams and these people financially if they're going to be semi-pro and to keep them involved in football. But, it's fundamentally, it is not good enough that this was the outcome of this.
No, I agree. And I think even if the decision was made March 13th, which is what the league is saying, The decision was made as a consequence of games that were cancelled much, much earlier in the season. I don't understand why the decision was coming out in mid-March. You knew you had a bottleneck of fixtures to fit in. You would have known that back in November, December, January, that you had this issue with the number of games you'd have to cancel. It all just seems like something was put off until the next committee meeting, as opposed to a decision being made as early as it could have been made.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it. Ruth, do you have anything else that you wanted to talk about here? Because we've gone through
I wanted to mention that the under-17s, they kick off in Hungary a week today on the 17th. They're playing the hosts in their first game of the Euros. The rest of the group is the Republic of Ireland and Poland. First and second in the group gets you through to a quarter final. So I think, you know, it's just really positive to see the underage groups qualifying for these tournaments. And I think it'll be great experience for the boys out in Hungary.
Absolutely. And points to a positive steps for the future as well. Like having slagged off the FAW, I think there's no discussion about how well they've done in terms of the pathways and how the younger age groups are set up. With that, of course,
just something to explain the sort of balance between professional and amateur football, Dave. One of the things that Mooney actually mentioned in that Q&A was that some of the lads in that tournament, they're going to be sitting A-levels, like doing exams on the morning or the afternoon and then playing a competitive game in the evening. And it's just like, it just shows you how much, you know, these individuals have to juggle just to try and live their dream of being a professional footballer. And I really, really felt for the lads when he pointed that out. It hadn't occurred to me. And I think, you know, just good luck to them on many fronts.
I was going to say, as teachers, that is absolutely brutal. You'd be absolutely pulling your hair out, wouldn't you? Why is little Johnny not coming to school today? Oh, he's off to Hungary for a football tournament. You would be livid. Anyway, we wouldn't be, but I know many people who would. Speaking of the younger age groups, obviously Chris Gunter was confirmed as obviously retiring from football at the end of the season, but as a consequence of that, he's going to be moving into a player development role with the FA. My God, I can't speak. With the FAW. A fantastic opportunity, I think. I'm personally delighted to see him involved in a younger level, but you know, I think the more people we can get involved from this class of 2016, if you like, to, you know, continue being part of the FAW's onward journey and, you know, making sure that things stay good and improve, and I think is really, really important. And delighted for him. I was fortunate enough to be asked to go on BBC Radio Wales. I don't know if I told you that actually, Ruth, to talk about this ever so briefly. But I think it's so positive that that Gunts has been retained, if you like, as part of the FAW, and hopefully he'll still be part of the senior squad in a coaching perspective moving forward. Anyway,
yeah, I think his kind of his role that he's had within the squad recently of that sort of conduit between the players and the fans and the players and the coaching staff, I think this hopefully is a very natural move for him to stay within the player development. And I think he's someone that's looked up to incredibly in terms of just the professional that he's been. I think he's a great model for the younger players as well, and in terms of who he is as a person and who he is as a footballer. It's also interesting to see Neil Taylor involved with the under-21s. So I think there's starting to be some growth, isn't there, around, as you say, the class of 16, as it were, they're going into retirement and starting to find their place in the coaching team. And it's not for everyone, but I'm glad to see some involvement. I think that experience is invaluable.
Absolutely. Was there anything else you wanted to mention, Ruth?
No, I think we've covered my AOB.
Oh, there you go. The agenda is complete, ladies and gentlemen. Well, thank you very much for listening. Thank you for your time, Ruth, as always.
Oh, no, good fun.
Absolutely. I want to say thank you to Shira the dog, who, you would not believe this, but has been sat next to me patiently the whole time and has not made one noise. So well done, Shira the dog. Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gents. Thanks for joining us. Don't forget to support us on buymeacoffee.com/Coleman's Dream. And of course, get involved at bagsybags.com and use the code CHAD10 for 10% off when you check out. Thank you very much for listening. We will be back very, very soon. Thank you and goodbye.
Bye-bye.